Can you hear me at home where you are? Give me a sign. There you go. Thank you. All right. So let's just sit for a few minutes. It's not quite seven. Give everybody a chance to show up. All right. Well, good evening, everybody. And thanks for joining us from your various places. So we're beginning this study of the Lotus Sutra, and we'll do this in six sessions, which means we will not cover all of it. So there's lots of things that we could get into, and I hope that we'll get into some of the most important parts of it. There's a lot about the Lotus Sutra that was very significant and interesting in the development of Mahayana Buddhism, particularly in Asia, that we won't really get into. But if you're interested, there's this book that's fairly new by Donald Lopez called The Lotus Sutra, A Biography. And it's kind of that. It's really kind of the story of the Lotus Sutra in India, in China, in Japan, and in the West. And I haven't actually finished reading it yet. But and he talks about, he sort of tracks its role, its influence in the development of Buddhism in all of these different parts of the world. And so if you're interested, it's a scholarly book, but a readable. Not so much about the Dharma, but more about just the story of the Lotus Sutra. So the Saddharma Puṇḍarīka Sutra, so you recognize it in Oryoki, we chant this as one of the names of the Buddha, right? And so it's to chant the name of the Lotus, of the sutra itself is to invoke the Buddha, invoke the name of the Buddha. The full title is the Sutra of the White Lotus of the True Dharma. And very briefly, the scholars think that it was composed over a period of about three centuries. And so this is a Mahayana sutra, obviously, and so it was composed after some good period of time after the death of the Buddha. And, you know, going back that far into history, particularly in India, it's hard for scholars to get a lot of information. There are a lot of history that was not really put down or retained, but they sort of speculate that because it was composed and added to over about three centuries, that based on that, they gleaned that it was important, that it was an influential sutra because it garnered that much attention and it merited that kind of ongoing sort of expanding on. And its influence on other schools, in particular, like the Pure Land School, the Nichiren School. Nichiren himself was sort of based his whole teaching on this. A lot of the development of that also was very much a part of the teaching of degeneration of Buddhism over the ages. I spoke about that a couple weeks ago. And that, which in a sense, in part means that it gets harder and harder over that period of disintegration for people to encounter the Dharma, to be able to meditate, and to be able to realize themselves. And so that became quite important in the development of the Pure Land and all of the sort of the schools that came out of Nichiren. I'm just going to mention a couple of things. Burton Watson, in the book that I'm reading from the translation, in his introduction, he talked about the word fa or dharma. that we translate as Dharma. And he talked about all the different ways that that word is used in the sutra itself. That sometimes it means Dharma, often it's translated as law in sutras. Sometimes it's translated as the teachings. Sometimes it's used in terms of referring to phenomena, things of the world, sometimes as method. And there are a lot of terms in Buddhism that are like that, where you have to really, you have to sort of get the sense of the word in terms of its context, which is sometimes challenging. Okay, so what I wanted to do was to tonight try and go through the first three chapters, which is a big bite. But what I want to do is the introduction. I just want to touch on that briefly and then concentrate in this first hour on the second sutra, second chapter of Expedient Means. And then in the next hour, we'll take a break, and next hour come back and look at this, the next chapter, which is simile and parable. So it's basically the first significant parable that the sutra brings forth. And it's one of the most well-known sutras, parables of the burning house. And so I wanted to give time to that. So as you know, because you've been studying this, so in the beginning, the stage is set in terms of where are we, who's there. There are lots of beings there. This is what I heard. At one time, the Buddha was in Rajagriha, staying on Mount Gurukutra. Accompanying him were a multitude of leading monks numbering 12,000 persons. All were arhats whose outflows had come to an end, who had no more earthly desires, who had attained what was to their advantage and had put an end to the bonds of existence, and whose mind had achieved a state of freedom. So he's kind of defining what an arhat is. We'll get into that a little bit later because it's very significant. And so the Buddha is sitting and he emits a ray of light from the tuft of hair between his eyebrows, which is one of the Buddha's characteristic features. A fully enlightened Buddha, of which in Buddhism there's only one every so often, has a number of distinguishing features, and that's one of them. And so everybody sees this light being manifested and begins to wonder what's going on, right? Why is the Buddha doing this? Because the Buddha never does anything in the sutras without a purpose. If he smiles, then the students will wonder, why is the Buddha smiling, right? And that almost always leads to the question, why are you smiling? And then he brings forth the Dharma. So Maitreya is wondering about this and is sort of thinking on behalf of everybody there and is thinking that people are starting to wonder and maybe have doubts, what's going on? Is this an auspicious sign? Is something getting ready to happen? And then Manjushri gets involved. And Manjushri remembers that a long time ago, he was in a previous period with another Buddha, and the same thing happened. And at that time, the Buddha expounded the Lotus Sutra. So this is a very interesting beginning, right? And is, without actually explaining much, is bringing out some of the sort of distinctive aspects of this sutra. And this, one of the sort of significances of this sutra is that it sort of brings forth some things, I don't know if it's for the first time, some notions that were very much part of Mahayana Buddhism, but made them very present and large. And so this notion of the Buddha, and of course the Buddha, you know, went through many, many lifetimes to get to the time where he was born as Shakyamuni. But here what Manjushri is saying is that he actually existed in previous time as the Buddha. And in fact, that there have been countless Buddhas going all the way back. And in this one particular time, the ray of light, the Lotus Sutra came forth. So maybe that's what's getting ready to happen. Okay, so everyone is poised. Okay. I also just wanted to say, in terms of reading this, studying this, this is in a way, it's a challenging sutra because, and Watson brings up some of those points about what makes it challenging. But in terms of just the readability, in terms of just being able to access the language and the literature, the sort of the basic message, in a way, it's much more accessible than some of the other sutras that are much more sort of like from the Prajnaparamita Sutra is very much sort of like the Diamond Sutra, you know, very sort of direct teaching that are much more less easily understandable just in terms of ordinary logic. And so the Lotus Sutra is a little bit more accessible. And I suspect that that was very significant in terms of how it was received historically by such a wide range of people, in particular lay practitioners. Dogen loved the Lotus Sutra, as I've mentioned before. He refers to it a lot. So let's look at the second chapter on expedient means. Now, I have not been able to find whether this is the first place. I'm sure it's not the first place that expedient means or upaya, skillful means, is brought forth. I mean, in a way, it's been there since the time of the Buddha. But in terms of being so explicit and such an explicit aspect of Buddha Dharma, a whole chapter is devoted to it. It comes up again and again and again in the sutra. So much is made of this notion of skillful means, of expedient means. So at that time, the World Honored One calmly arose from his samadhi and addressed Shariputra. And the Buddha is almost always expounding the Dharma from within samadhi. Right? So he's speaking from within a state of samadhi. And so he begins, "The wisdom of the Buddhas is infinitely profound and immeasurable. The door to this wisdom is difficult to understand and difficult to enter. Not one of the voice hearers or Pratyeka Buddhas is able to comprehend it." So he has just exploded a bomb. because who's in the audience? Voice hearers, not necessarily Pratyeka Buddhas, because they're more on their own, they're more solitary, but voice hearers is a Mahayana term for the disciples of the Buddha. And so let's sort of get clear on what those terms mean. And remember, this is all from the perspective of Mahayana Buddhism. So as Mahayana Buddhism was developing in India and then on into Asia and Tibet, and it evolved not as a coherent thing, you know, that we are Mahayana and we are developing. It was just sort of communities of practitioners around the place, all over the place, who were sort of evolving in practices and teachings and developing sutras, which came to be sort of all held within this sense of what we now refer to as the Mahayana. Mahayana means great vehicle. The term Hinayana, which you sometimes hear, it means lesser vehicle. And so that's a pejorative term that was used by the Mahayana to refer to early Buddhism, that is pre-Mahayana Buddhism or non-Mahayana Buddhism. And from that sort of traditional perspective is seen as a lesser vehicle, not as highly evolved. Okay, so that's a very important thing to sort of get in terms of how these teachings are presented from the Mahayana perspective. So the arhat, it means worthy one. An arhat is somebody who was a disciple of the Buddha and basically came to enlightenment in accord with what the Buddha was teaching. So from within that early tradition, this was somebody who basically realized what the Buddha was teaching and was encouraging people to discover. And which meant that they had freed themselves of all of their karmic afflictions. They had, very importantly, ended their rounds of rebirth. So this, becoming an arhat meant you would not be reborn again, that you had severed that endless loop of cyclic lives in samsara, which meant suffering, that you had finally freed yourself of that, and that at death had attained full nirvana. Full nirvana meaning that that even in realization, as long as we have a physical body, we're still sort of, in some way, still tethered to our karma, because the body is manifesting because of our karma. And so it's not until death that the realized being is fully freed, because now they're freed of the physical body, which is tethered. Okay? So those are sort of the distinguishing characteristics of an arhat. So Shariputra, all of these disciples are disciples of the Buddha and considered highly evolved, highly realized beings. Manjushri, Maitreya, these are bodhisattvas. So they're Mahayana. So we've got sort of a mixed crowd here. Okay? And so that's significant in terms of when you're reading the sutra, who's talking? Who's asking the question? Who's answering the question? Right? Because often in the Mahayana sutras, the disciples, the arhats, are sort of presenting the Dharma or the question and making it clear that they don't fully understand. The bodhisattvas will then respond from a clearer place, right? And one of the, well, so what's the difference between an arhat and a bodhisattva? The essential difference is that the bodhisattva, the Mahayana, sees the arhat as somebody who has dedicated themselves to liberating themselves from suffering. That their commitment is they want to free themselves from cyclic existence and from suffering. It does not include the bodhisattva vow. They are not doing that in service to all sentient beings. They are not intending to return for another round of life so that they can actually show up and serve sentient beings, which is the vow of the bodhisattva. So that's why Mahayana Buddhism sees the arhat as being a lesser path, because it's seen from the Mahayana perspective, and this is very important to understand, that it's seen as a more self sort of invested or motivated path, whereas the bodhisattva has liberated themselves so profoundly of any vestige of the self that their whole reason for being is to liberate others. Okay. The Shravaka is translates as a voice here. And so that's another term for arhat. So they're basically synonymous. So they, again, are, from the Mahayana perspective, are sort of invested in self-liberation. Now, is this just purely, made up? Because it could suggest that the early schools and those practicing Theravada Buddhism have no interest in compassion and have no interest in other people, which is, of course, not true at all. And that the emphasis on the bodhisattva and the bodhisattva vow and service to others is very central in Mahayana Buddhism, and it isn't really the central theme in early Buddhism. And if you read the early teachings, you'll see that, I mean, in a sense, the Buddha is a perfect example of a bodhisattva, right? He spent his whole life teaching and taking on the burden of forming a community, right, and leading this community, which is not, such an easy thing, and brings with it all kinds of problems which he encountered. And so even though he was a fully realized Buddha, he really, lived his life as a bodhisattva. Part of the understanding of the Shravaka or the arhat too is that the Mahayana recognizes that there is enlightenment. They do recognize that the arhat has realized enlightenment, but that the critique is that they end there. That's sort of the finality of their path. Whereas for the bodhisattva, enlightenment is just continues, right? Because it's not, their vow is not finished because they are here to alleviate suffering of others. And so there's, it continues on. The Pratyeka Buddha is somebody who is recognized as having come to enlightenment on their own. So they're sometimes, it's defined as a solitary Buddha. And so they are actually held in pretty high regard because, you know, they did it by themselves. They didn't study with a teacher. They, you know, they're not practicing with a community. They've really come to enlightenment through their own efforts. But that's as far as it goes. So they're not necessarily interested in teaching others. They're not interested in or committed to alleviating suffering of others. So again, from a Mahayana perspective, it's seen as falling short of its full potential. Okay, so we've got this august assembly of all of these very mature disciples of the Buddha. And the Buddha begins this teaching by saying, the wisdom of the Buddhas is infinitely profound and immeasurable. It is difficult to understand and difficult to enter. Now, why is he saying this to all of these people who have realized enlightenment? And then he goes on to say, not one of the voice hearers or Pratyeka Buddhas, not one of you is able to comprehend it. So this is a little bit of a shock, right? What is the reason for this? A Buddha has personally attended 100,000, 10,000, million, countless number of Buddhas and has carried out an immeasurable number of religious practices. These Buddhas have used countless expedient means to guide living beings and cause them to renounce their attachments. Why? Because the thus come one, another name for the Buddha, is fully possessed of both expedient means and the paramita of wisdom. And that's really important, that expedient means without wisdom is not yet expedient means. Wisdom without expedient means is not yet the bodhisattva path because it's not active, right? It's not being offered. And so he goes on to speak about some of the qualities of the Buddha. The true entity of all phenomena can only be understood and shared between Buddhas. And then he goes on to say in the verse, even if the whole world, he said, this Dharma cannot be described. Words fall silent before it. Even if the whole world were filled with people like Shariputra, and Shariputra was known as the most realized of all the disciples. So even if the whole world were filled with people like Shariputra, though they exhausted their thoughts and pooled their capacities, they could not fathom the Buddha's knowledge. If Pratyeka Buddhas, acute in understanding, so on and so forth, were to join all of their forces together, they could not understand the smallest part of it. So he's basically saying there, the Buddha, this Buddha, has a wisdom that no one else has yet encountered. So if you think of this as drama, this is a very dramatic moment, right? So from the very beginning, there is a tremendous tension that the Buddha has pumped into the atmosphere. And I'm just picking on pieces, okay, to touch on. At one point he says, towards the Dharma preached by the Buddhas, you must cultivate a great power of faith. And I encourage you to really, as you're studying this, just note each time that is mentioned. Because it's one of the themes of the sutra, is this matter of faith. That only those who have faith can actually encounter the Dharma. Okay, now faith is an important part of all Buddhism, but this sutra really brings that out and makes quite an emphasis on the role of faith, which had a very important role in some of these other, like the Pure Land, and I don't want to speak about these in detail because it's not my training, and you know I've just studied it from another tradition, but the Pure Land and the Nichiren schools and some of these other schools were really based in the idea that humanity had gotten to the point where we could no longer, they could no longer come to enlightenment on their own. things had just gotten too, you know, diffuse. And so the idea that a person could only come to realization through the help, through the support of an enlightened being, and the role of faith in that, right? Because you're no longer really relying. I mean, it's not that they don't have a practice and they don't have things they have to do, but that it's this notion of you know, really sort of relying on your own resources and realizing your own mind through your own sort of natural Buddha qualities and virtues, to that those are no longer sufficient supply, and I need to reach out and, in a sense, supplicate and ask for the support of another Buddha like Amitabha. And that faith plays a very important role in that, which you could imagine, right? If you're relying upon something that is not entirely within yourself, then you better believe in that, right? You really will need to trust that that's true in order for that to have power. Now, everybody in the assembly at that time, all among the great assembly, there were voice hearers, arhats, who had come, outflow has come to an end. That is, they'd liberated themselves from the kleshas. And there were monks, nuns, laymen, laywomen who had conceived a desire to become voice hearers and pratyekabuddhas. So there were all of these people who were not yet enlightened, but were aspiring to. And each of these had this thought. Now, for what reason does the world honored one so earnestly praise expedient means and state that the law by the Buddha is difficult and profound, and that not one of the voice hearers or pratyekabuddhas can do so? So everybody's in a field of doubt, right? So Shariputra understands that everybody is filled with doubt, and he comes to the Buddha and says, you know, everybody's basically like a little upset and would really like some clarification here. And Shariputra says, among the assembly of voice hearers, the Buddha has said, I am the foremost in wisdom, and yet now I lack the wisdom that I thought I had to solve these doubts. I don't have the wisdom to solve these doubts and perplexities that we all have. Have I in fact grasped the ultimate law, or am I still on the path of practice? Because again, from the point of view of the arhat, once they reach that point, their path is essentially done. They've achieved it. And so he's wondering, I thought I had done that. Is that not so? And so the Buddha is addressing Shariputra is addressing the Buddha, and the Buddha says, stop. Stop. There is no need to speak further. If I speak of this matter, then the heavenly and human beings throughout the worlds will all be astonished and doubtful. And Shariputra says, no, we beg you to preach. We need to understand. What is the reason you're saying this? The Buddha says again, stop. I cannot speak of this. And then he goes on to say, the monks who are overbearingly arrogant will fall into a great pit if I speak of this. And then Shariputra asks again, and this also comes up a lot in the teachings, where, and this may be a cultural thing. I've never actually checked this out, but a cultural Indian practice of asking three times means I mean it. And whatever the consequence of my asking is, I take responsibility for that. And so the Buddha is trying to say, no, no, you actually don't want to know. Or could the Buddha be wanting to make sure, wanting to sort of cultivate a deep desire to know? In other words, is he helping? Is he resisting this to sort of encourage, cultivate, bring forth a great mind of questioning, right? And so the Buddha says, three times you've stated your earnest request. How can I now do other than preach? So listen attentively and carefully ponder. For your sake, I will now analyze and explain the matter. And then at that point, and this is one of those historic moments, when he had spoken these words, there were some 5,000 monks, nuns, laymen, and laywomen, and that's referred to as the fourfold Sangha. So the Buddha taught that there is a fourfold Sangha consisting of male and female, monastic and lay. And these immediately rose from their seats, bowed to the Buddha, and withdrew. The sutra says, what was the reason for this? These persons had roots of guilt that were deep and manifold, and in addition, they were overbearingly arrogant. What they had not attained, they supposed they had attained. What they had not understood, they supposed they had understood. And because they had this failing, they did not remain where they were. The World Honored One was silent and did not try to detain them. And then the Buddha said, now this assembly of mine is free of branches and leaves, made up solely of the steadfast and truthful. Shariputra, it is well that these persons of overbearing arrogance have withdrawn. Now, listen carefully, and I will preach for you. Okay, so let's just stop there and just see if there's any questions or comments thus far. And do the folks at home know how what's happening for them, Yusen? So you guys, what we're going to ask you guys at home to do, if you want to ask questions, can you send it in through the chat? That will seem to work better than trying to bring you onto the screen. Okay, and then Yusen will read them out. So be encouraged to write in your questions, and then we'll try and get to those. Okay. Cool. Right, and we also have a mic, so please wait until you have a mic so everybody can hear.
So the Buddha has become this cosmic, it's like the Buddha is no longer just a person. I was thinking about this the other night as I was introducing the new residents and saying the Buddha was just a person and I knew what was coming tonight.
Yes. And we're, so he's really, you know, he's saying this and he's basically hinting at this. He hasn't yet come out. Later in the sutra, he comes full on and says that as so, and sort of gives the fuller sense of that, which is one of the very important themes of this sutra. And it's one of the things that the early Buddhists had a considerable problem with, right? Because in early Buddhism, the Buddha is a Buddha. Buddha is a person. And that the idea that in the Buddha's Parinirvana, that in some way he continues on, seems to sort of disturb that whole notion of what Parinirvana is, right? If he's still present, if he's like, that's not consistent with the original understanding. So yes, here Buddha is basically becoming a cosmic being who is always present and for a very particular purpose, which he makes clear. So how are we to understand this, right? So as a student of the Dharma, I'm sure that there are many people throughout history who have understood this quite literally, right? And do understand this quite literally. You know, it's Western Buddhism that has sort of, in a way, sort of introduces profound re-understanding, you might say, of what Buddhism is, which is that it for many, many Western Buddhists, it's no longer based in this sort of very deep and essential understanding of the endless cycles of rebirth, which is basically what gives, from a traditional viewpoint, sort of both the power of the endless cycles of suffering, that you have to go through it over and over and over again, that there's no release from that until there's realization, but also, for the very same reason, gives you endless opportunities to encounter the Dharma, to raise bodhicitta, to liberate yourself, right? for Western Buddhists, that's very often not part of their, our understanding of what we're doing, which from a traditional Buddhist view is a huge, pretty big thing. And so that sense of, you know, not just cosmic, but just of, you know, the endlessness nature of the cycles of life. Because in Buddhism, there is no beginning, right? There is no point at which there was not samsara, there were not these cycles of existence. That is infinite from a Buddhist perspective. Because based on the understanding of mind and consciousness, there can be no point at which it was non-existent and then suddenly on its own came into existence. That sort of goes against not only the teachings, but how we understand consciousness. So,
And we also sort of overlook the many lifetimes of the Buddha before he was a Buddha.
You mean don't really spend a lot of time with that?
Yeah. And emphasize that, well, he did it in his own lifetime, and so we can too.
That what he did in his own lifetime?
He realized Buddhahood in his own lifetime.
Yes.
And so we can too.
Yes. Yes.
And we're getting a different story here.
No, but that he did do it in this lifetime, but all of those previous lifetimes was ripening that fruit. You know? And of course, for him to become the Buddha is different from us realizing enlightenment. I mean, that's an important distinction. And in Mahayana Buddhism, we use that word Buddha to refer to just our Buddha nature. We have enlightened nature, which is true. Therefore, we refer to ourselves and each other as Buddhas. From a Mahayana perspective, that's not wrong. But that's not to be understood as the same as a fully enlightened Buddha, right? Because again, from a Buddhist perspective, those only come not that often. That has all of those qualities of the Buddha and has all of those enlightened, you know, wisdoms and so on.
Okay, we have a question from Joe.
Mm-hmm.
Does the Buddha at Parinirvana tie into the primordial Buddha, from whence we speak of numerous Nirmanakaya Shakyamuni Buddhas? Was this a persistence of Buddha nature past the extinction of the man, Gautama Siddhartha?
Okay, well, there are a lot of questions in that question. So, yeah. But let me just say this, that I think we could think of the primordial Buddha. I mean, that could mean different things, depending on how you're using that term. It could be understood as the Buddha, the cosmic nature of the Buddha, which is really free of thingness. And so the Nirmanakaya is the, when the Buddha was born as Shakyamuni, and he makes this clear, he's an eternal Buddha, basically, so he's always present, right? But he came forth as Shakyamuni so that he could appear to us, to disciples, and they could listen to his teachings and practice and come to realization. So he took on this human form so that he could, because we can only study with a living teacher, right? And so that's called the Nirmanakaya, the manifestation body of the Buddha. But I want to just touch on a couple of themes that come up in this chapter, because they begin here, but then they'll keep coming back to us. So he says, and if you're in the book, I'm on page 31, he says, the Buddha's wish to open the door of Buddha wisdom to all living beings, to allow them to attain purity. That is why they appear in the world. So that's really an expression of the Bodhisattva vow. The reason he has come into this world is to open the door of Buddha wisdom to us. They wish to show the Buddha wisdom to living beings, therefore they appear. They wish to cause living beings to awaken to the Buddha wisdom, thus they appear. They wish to induce living beings to enter the path, and so they appear. Shariputra, this is the one great reason for which the Buddhas appear in the world. Okay, so that's the great vow. Now, a couple of paragraphs down, he says, Shariputra, the thus come ones, and he's referring here now to all the Buddhas who have ever existed, have only a single Buddha vehicle, which they employ in order to preach the Dharma, the law, to living beings. They do not have any other vehicle, a second one or a third one. The law preached by all the Buddhas of the Ten Directions is the same as this. So this is another very sort of big moment, a big pronouncement. And what he's referring to here is the Shravaka, the Arhat vehicle, the Pratyeka Buddha vehicle. So these are different paths, right, that a person can take and aspire to. Or the Bodhisattva path. And what the Buddha is saying, he's just said that these other two vehicles, the Arhats and the Pratyeka Buddhas, have not yet realized it, which would seem to suggest that they're on a completely different path or on not on the same path, right? They're in a different vehicle. But what he's saying, and that's a very sort of ubiquitous teaching in Mahayana Buddhism, is the sort of definition of these three paths. And what the Buddha is saying is, no, there's really just one vehicle. And that's very significant because he's including everybody, right? So he starts out by saying, you know, you have thought that you were enlightened, and in fact, I affirm that for you. Like, they didn't just make it up, right? They weren't self-proclaiming. They were affirmed by the Buddha, and he's basically saying, yes, I did, and it wasn't actually entirely true. And, but you are not on a separate vehicle. We're all in one vehicle. And I think of that in our times as, you know, being in this country where for the first time in history, we have access to virtually every Buddhist tradition and teachings and practices. Many, many of which would never have been taught or communicated in the way that they are being communicated now via the internet, you know, where anybody can, or in a course that's on the internet, that they would have been done like this, face to face. And, you know, you had to travel. I mean, what did Dogen have to do being dissatisfied with the teachings that he was encountering in Japan? At the risk of everything, right? He got on a ship and went to China. And so I think of this one vehicle, because we can think of, well, there's Theravada Buddhism, there's insight meditation, American tradition, Jack Kornfield, Joseph Goldstein, there's all the many schools of Tibetan Buddhism, there's Pure Land Buddhism, Nichiren Buddhism, there's some different lineages and schools of Zen. And to think of that, in a sense, as our one vehicle, right? Different teachings, different practices, but ultimately one vehicle. And in that sense, the teachings and practices can't be fundamentally different. They can have differences, but they can't be ultimately different, not if they're all one vehicle. And I think that's a good way for us to think of it, because there has been, through the history of Buddhism, just as we're seeing here, sectarianism. You know, who's got the real deal? Who's got the true Dharma? Right? And it's kind of natural. You know, if I, you know, am drawn to a tradition, a teaching, and I was and am, because it really speaks to me more than others, and I commit to it and I invest in it and I really put my ass on the line, and it opens the door for me, then I am going to have a very particular relationship with that body of teaching, right? That is going to be kind of biased, right? Because it's what I know, and it's what really worked for me. And then it's not that big a leap to think, well, you know, it would really be best for you too. And that other thing that you're doing doesn't really cut it. And so, you know, we've seen that over and over and over again. And so we do not need to perpetuate that. So that's why I think of this one vehicle teaching in this particular vein, which is not traditionally how it's understood, just to make that clear. Okay.
Should I go? Okay, I'll go real quick. Can you talk a bit more about the emphasis on miracles, signs, wonders, huge crowds, multiple worlds, etc., in the Mahayana Sutras? What purpose and effect do they have? And somebody else also asked, is the Mahayana empty?
Is the Mahayana empty?
Empty.
It better be. Otherwise, we're in serious trouble. All things are empty. Nothing has inherent, intrinsic existence, qualities, attributes, characteristics. That's what makes them. If a teaching was not of that nature, it could not be true. It could not be trustworthy, right? Because by definition, it would be conditioned, which means it would come apart. And more importantly, it couldn't be a true teaching about the nature of reality, because reality isn't like that. Reality is unconditioned. And so the vehicles that we use, like language, like schools, like everything, take forms that we use to help us turn towards and study and understand the Dharma. But part of our responsibility in practice is to understand more and more clearly and then directly that all of that is what? I've already given you the tip. Expedient means. It's all expedient means, which doesn't mean the fact that it's not inherent, it's not permanent or have an inherent existence, doesn't mean that it's not true. It just means that it doesn't have an inherent existence, just like we don't. I was looking for, because I think Watson talks about this, but I think I would ask that question back. You know, when you read the sutra, if you really read it, and you read it in a contemplative way, you enter into it, and you don't just sort of skim over all of the, you know, worlds and so on, and then just look, what does that do to your mind, right, if you just enter into that? And so sometimes it's spoken of as a way to loosen our tether a little bit, soften our grip on the idea of sort of our materialistic sort of grasp of the world, that what is what can be touched and held. And that if I can't hold it, if I can't put it on a balance scale, then it doesn't exist. And that the sutras are vast, right? They are impossible. Right, they present worlds upon worlds upon worlds. But have you ever looked at your mind? Have you ever seen all the worlds there? The ones you create? So consider that, right? And so here is the creation of an enlightened world, right, with all of these enlightened beings, right, which I don't believe, or I don't take them as literal, but I also don't disregard them.
Question. If I were in that audience at that time and the Buddha said, no, there's not three vehicles, there's just the one vehicle, and I was part of the fourfold Sangha that you mentioned, mm-hmm. I would feel like a frisson of liberation as a woman, that it would be possible for me to be equal in the one vehicle. Mm-hmm. And I always took the Mahayana view as sort of equalizing. all the assemblies, and that some people really couldn't put up with that, so they left.
Yes, and I mean, that's even consistent with the early teachings, because the Buddha was very clear and said on different occasions that there was no lack of capacity for lay people, women, anyone to realize himself. He did say that conditions, life circumstances, and so on could make it more difficult. He did say that. But even though that's true, what you say, and that's really important, at the same time, what we see, like, who is he talking to, right? These parables, like the burning house, who is the father trying to get out? His sons, right? So it's still very much bound in the male form and directed towards. And so my suggestion, what I do when I'm reading, and I've been doing this so long, it's just a habit, is I just am constantly translating when I'm reading. So sons become daughters, or they just become people. You know, they're just people. Their gender is not, sometimes it's important. Most of the time it's not. And so I encourage students who do koan training to do the same thing if they're working with a koan that is where they're really going to be sort of engaging, you know, a person, and they're in a male form, to put them into a female form. Right, so that, and for men and women to be able to relate, to identify both with all genders, we could include non-conforming as well, but also to so we can ultimately go beyond that.
I guess I'm also curious how much this, our view of equality and gender equality in monk and lay, is imputed into, you know, this whole thing about the vehicles, which to them at the time was really important, but was also this other aspect at play in the communities? Or is this sort of, because it was written over three centuries, yeah, there was a lot of things going on, and we don't even know what was really happening in the communities?
No, not really. No. I mean, we get glimpses. You know, we know that in the Zen tradition there were women and women masters who studied in monasteries with male teachers. We know that there were men who studied with women teachers. But, you know, the emphasis on those records are scant, right? And on the stories and histories of women, dharma, you know, women of the way, is scant, because the men were telling the stories. And so we have to write that now. So let me just see before we take the break. So he basically continues to reiterate the teaching of this one vehicle, the fact that those who are already present have not yet fully realized it. He says, I know that living beings have various desires and attachments that are deeply implanted in their minds. Taking cognizance of this basic nature of theirs, I will therefore use various causes and conditions, words of simile and parable, and the power of expedient means, and expound the law for them. I do this all so that they may attain the one Buddha vehicle and wisdom embracing all species. There are not two vehicles, much less three. He says, when the age is impure, and then here he's referring to this sort of degenerate age, when the age is impure and the times are chaotic, then the defilements of living beings are grave. That's one of the qualities, that people are sort of more deluded than usual, right? And acting out of that delusion. They are greedy and jealous and put down roots that are not good. Like, if we sort of use this as a test against our time, doesn't look so good. They also don't live as long. They're less able to meditate. I think it was Lopez made a point of this, because he brought this out, and he made a point about Dogen, for instance, who didn't buy into that. and said he thought that his time, the time he was in, was a robust time. He said he did feel like there was a lot of not very solid Dharma going on, which is why he went to China. But he felt that, you know, people were fully capable. Okay, so any thoughts or questions on this? I know I've moved kind of quickly through it.
Mm-hmm. I'm still thinking about the 5,000 hearers that left. It seems significant, like in myself, my own arrogance of not listening to the teachings in a moment because I think I know. But what the other reason was manifold guilt. What is the guilt about? Why did they leave because of guilt?
Well, I mean, if you imagine yourself in that place and really feeling quite confident and comfortable in your attainment and what you have with no small effort made your life about, and then here's your teacher, right, presenting this, you know, that would sort of put you on a pivot point, right? Do you lean in? You know, do you have a student mind? Do you, so overbearingly proud and arrogant is not wanting to let go, you know, not wanting to, you know, consider the possibility that there is more. I mean, even just that, the idea that one has come to a conclusion, you know, puts one in a very precarious state, right? Because anything they experience has to be consistent with that conclusion, right? Which is not going to work out well. And so I think why did they think that was so important? I mean, it's really emphasizing the sort of profound nature of what the Buddha is getting ready to convey, but it's also highlighting the difference, I think, between the Bodhisattva path and the danger of these other paths, you know, of leading to pride, leading to, you know, a lack of humility or openness. And I think, you know, that's part of why it's powerful is to sort of reflect on that within ourselves, you know, all the ways in which in our own smaller ways we might experience that. I just want to bring your attention. I won't read through it because it's a longer passage, but in the Watson translation on 38, there's this interesting passage where he says, middle of the page, if there are living beings who have encountered these past Buddhas and they've listened to the law, presented alms, kept the precepts, shown forbearance, been assiduous, practiced meditation, wisdom, and so forth, cultivating various kinds of merit and virtue, then persons such as these all have attained the Buddha way. After the Buddhas have passed into extinction, if persons are of good and gentle mind, then living beings such as these have all attained the way. And he goes on with all of these, you know, if a person has done this or has brought themselves to this or has this quality or has brought forth this virtue, they have all attained the Buddha way. And then he says, the original vow of the Buddhas was that the Buddha way, which they themselves practice, should be shared universally among living beings so that they too may attain the way. Right? And so remember, we're studying Buddha nature, right? Buddha nature, that we are each endowed universally with this nature, having all the virtues, all the qualities of a Buddha, but must be practiced and realized. And so that universal aspect of the Buddha, that no matter what you do, no matter how you live your life, you never even have a thought about this, never care about this, Maybe your life is a train wreck. And you have Buddha nature, right? And because nothing is fixed, you always have the possibility. Always have the possibility of encounter, of shift, of turning, of hearing something for the first time. The Buddha's most honored of two-legged beings know that phenomena have no constantly fixed nature, that the seeds of Buddhahood sprout through causation, and for this reason they preach the single Dharma, because everyone has that capacity. Okay? All right. So let's take a break, all right, for about, let's say, 5 minutes, not long, and we'll come back and then take up the next chapter. Okay.
So is the radical teaching that like the Dharma that the Buddha's like putting out there for the first time, this thing that like everyone's going to become a Buddha? I mean, is that part of it?
Well, see, that's one of the so-called enigmas of the sutra. Let me see, Watson, Donald Lopez mentions this. If I can find it. I don't want to spend too much time on this, but there's a question of what actually is
right.
The teaching.
Watson talks about that too in the
yeah.
intro. Yeah,
and so I think we'll just leave that question open for now, right? And examine that as we go. So, at the end of that second chapter, the Buddha. Is talking to Shariputra and says, at the very end, you will have no more doubts or perplexities, but your minds filled with great joy will know that you yourselves will attain Buddhahood. So he's basically telling everybody there that they will attain enlightenment. And so the next chapter starts off with Shariputra saying, just now when I heard from the Buddha, my mind seemed to dance and I gained what I'd never had before. I heard a law of this kind from the Buddha and saw how the bodhisattvas received prophecies that in time they would attain Buddhahood. I and the others felt that we had no part in the affair, but that now the Buddha has basically offered that. And he gets quite specific as the sutra goes on with specific predictions that individual beings will attain enlightenment. And then Shariputra speaks on the next page about his not having, having sort of attained a lesser realization. And he says, but the fault is ours, not the Buddha's. Why do I say this? If we had been willing to wait until the true means for attaining Anuttara Samyakpa Sambuddhi was preached, then we would have attained the release through the great vehicle. In other words, why did the Buddha wait until now? Why didn't he offer this at the very beginning, this teaching? And so the notion of expedient means is that for something to be expedient, it has to be based in true dharma. It also has to meet the needs and the capacity of the person. Right? And so, I mean, that's a sort of a traditional Mahayana perspective on why, if these Mahayana sutras are valid, why weren't they there at the very beginning? Why did they appear later? And the reason is, from the Mahayana perspective, is that people weren't ready. The disciples, in fact, it said that when the Buddha was first enlightened, he taught the Avatamsaka Sutra, which would have been a very long discourse. And that everybody was completely lost. And so, because the Buddha was giving his full Monty, right? And people were like, what are you talking about? So he realized, oh, they are not ready to hear this. And so he stepped it back. He put that away. He stepped back and he started with the Four Noble Truths. And basically taught early Buddhism, right? What Mahayana Buddhism considers early Buddhism, which is part of Mahayana Buddhism too. To basically get us ready to be able to hear these teachings. And that's basically how training works. You know, we start with teachings that we can hear and make sense of and apply ourselves to. They're true, but they're not the full teaching, right? Because we just actually aren't ready. Right? We could hear them, we could listen to them, we could read them, but we wouldn't absorb them, right? There wouldn't kind of be an affinity. There wouldn't be a place for them to land. It would be very difficult for us to practice them because we wouldn't have prepared ourselves yet. And so it's not just an idea of something. I think it's really based in how the path unfolds. So there's this, essentially this first prediction of Buddhahood for the Buddha on the bottom of page 51 says directly to Shariputra, you will fulfill every aspect of the way of the Bodhisattva and will be able to become a Buddha with the name Flower Glow. So he even tells him who he will be in this future lifetime. And it's always a future lifetime in which this is going to happen. Okay, so now the Buddha comes to this first parable. And so he reiterates that he is going to use similes and parables and other expressions employing expedient means. He's basically explaining what an expedient means is. And so he says, I too will now make use of similes and parables to further clarify this doctrine. And so then he says, suppose that in a certain town, in a certain country, And he begins this story. So there's a very rich person who's far along in years, is very wealthy, has houses and fields and servants, big old rambling house, right? But there's only one gate. There's only one way out, okay? So that's what makes you so rich, is you know, to look at what do these things mean, right? Because it's not about a house. A great many people, 100, 200, as many as 500, lived in this house. The halls and rooms were old and decaying, the walls crumbling, the pillars rotten at their base, the beams and rafters crooked and aslant, right? What is this house? Shout it out. What is this house?
The world.
Samsara, right? The Buddha said, the house is on fire. The house is burning. The world is burning. It's burning in our eyes. It's burning in our ears. It's burning in our words. It's burning in our thoughts. And so here's this house, which is large. It's impressive, right? It speaks of great wealth, but actually it's falling apart. Right? We could also think of this house as this house, right? Which has grandeur, but it's kind of fallen apart. Some of you don't know that yet. And enjoy your immortality while it lasts. And then suddenly a fire breaks out on all sides, spreading throughout all the rooms. And the children of this rich person are inside the house. So the parent sees the flames, right? And they realize everybody's in danger. And being the parent, loving the children, they want more than anything to save these children from this fire, right? But my children are inside the burning house, enjoying themselves and playing games, unaware, unknowing. They have no alarm. They're not afraid. The fire is closing in on them. Suffering and pain threaten them, yet their minds have no sense of loathing or peril, and they do not even think of trying to escape. Loathing here means sort of no longer being infatuated by samsara. Sort of turning again, losing our taste for those sort of transient pleasures that fade so quickly and just bring disappointment again. Right? And so everybody's in the house playing games. Pick your game. Shariputra, and so this rich person thinks to himself, I have the strength in my bodies and arms. I could wrap them in a robe and place them on a bench and carry them out of this house. And then they say that the parent says, but the house has only one gate and it's narrow and small. Right? So the parent decides not to try and carry them out. So it says because the gate is very small, but why can't the parent carry the children out? Why don't they do that? They have the power. Why don't they do that?
You have to come to the Dharma yourself.
I can't hear you.
You have to come to the Dharma yourself.
They're going to resist.
Right. They don't want to leave. So think about it. They don't want to leave. They're having a high time. They're not afraid. So when the father tries to carry them out, they are going to resist. And a little bit later, the Buddha says what happens if you try and force this. If you try and force the Dharma on somebody, it's not pretty. So the parent discards that as an option. He says, but my children are so young, they have no understanding. They love their games. They're so engrossed in them. But they are very likely to be burned in the fire. I must explain to them why I'm afraid for them. I have to get them out. And so the parent goes to the children and explains to them, you have to come out. You have to come out at once. The house is on fire. So the parent sees the fire. The children don't see the fire. They're in the same house. They're looking at the same thing. They don't see the fire. The parent does. And so when the parent says, the house is on fire, they say, what are you talking about? We're having fun, right? Why are you messing this up? They were absorbed in their games and unwilling to heed them. They had no alarm, no fright, and in the end, no mind to leave the house. They didn't understand what the fire was. They didn't understand what the house was. They didn't understand what the danger was. They merely raced about this way and that in play and looked at their father without heeding him. You know, this comes up a lot in present day practice because in many ways, many practitioners, many people in the world do not live like this, but many practitioners live as veritable gods, right? We have ample shelter and food and water and clothing, and we can go on trips and we can live long lives if we're fortunate. We have medicine, we have entertainment, we have just at the flick of a wrist, light, warmth. So many of those things that sort of pressed in and do still press in on people and made life very, very difficult, very precarious, right? We have pushed back quite a bit. And so sometimes it's really hard to relate to this kind of language. You know, it's like, wait a minute, life is pretty good, you know. And so I think on one level, it's just appreciating that our, you know, historically and still for many people, what life is like. And also that our lives will have, for many of us, and will experience great challenges. Right? Because we live in a human body, we live in a world with other people. And so this image of a house that's on fire, that's burning, I think becomes more real for each of us at different times. You know, it's not so metaphorical. And certainly, I mean, even if your life is blessed, thank goodness, but look around. You don't have to look far. And so this sense of wanting to be free of that kind of precariousness, you know, that kind of lack of control of, you know, because there's so much we can't control outside of ourselves. But how can we liberate ourselves? Is it possible for there to be a liberation within ourselves such that whatever we experience, we can be less bound or unbound or free? So the parent says, if I don't get my children out at once, they are certain to be burned. So then it says the parent understood their children. They knew them. The parent knew their children, knew their minds, and knew what various toys and curious objects each child customarily liked and would delight in. Right? So expedient means, right? How do you reach the person? And so the parent said, the kind of playthings you like are rare and hard to find. If you don't take them when you can, you'll surely regret it later. So he's got their interest. What? Something rare? Something I might regret if I don't get it? And he said, for example, things like a go-kart or a deer cart or an ox cart. There happen to be some just outside the gate. If you come out now, you can play with them. I'll give one to you. But you have to come out at once. And at that time, the children heard their parent telling them about these rare playthings. And because such things were just what they wanted, they felt emboldened in their heart and pushing and shoving, like to the Doksan line. The old Doksan line. They all came wildly dashing out of the burning house. We used to, for those of you who are newer, we used to run with great enthusiasm to the Doksan line as a way of expressing that enthusiasm. And sometimes it got a little of a contact sport. Huh?
It did. I'm just flashing back. Yeah. It totally did.
People leaping over people, and yeah, it was... That's right, the chair, a veritable weapon.
Exactly.
Right. So we have... So at that time, they heard and they went out because, of course, they want these things. And all of the children got out safely. And they were all seated on the open ground, no longer in danger, greatly relieved. So now the parent is greatly relieved. Their mind is dancing with joy. And now, of course, it's like pony up time. So they said, these playthings you promised us, where are they? I want them. Give them to me now. It says, Shatiputra, at that time, this rich person gave to each of the children a large carriage of uniform size and quality. They were tall and spacious, adorned with numerous jewels. And of course, the carriage is the vehicle, the one vehicle. There are not three. There is not a goat cart, a deer cart, and an ox cart. There's only one cart. And it is rich. And the parent says, the parent's wealth was limitless. They had many storehouses. And they said, he thought to himself, there's no end to my possessions. It wouldn't be right if I were to give my children small carriages. Right? I have ample wealth. Right? The Buddha has ample wisdom. Why would I give them a lesser wisdom? Why would I give them a lesser treasure? It would not be right. These children are all, these little ones are all my children. I love them all without partiality. I love them all. That's the heart, that's the love of the Bodhisattva. You know, in the immeasurable, the third immeasurable, the fourth immeasurable of equanimity is another way of understanding it, is impartiality. May all beings dwell in impartiality. May they see all people, all things impartially, right, equally. So at that time, each of the children mounted their large carriage, gaining something they had never had before, something they had originally never expected. Okay. So now the question the Buddha asks, what do you think? Was this parent guilty of a falsehood or not? Did they tell a lie? Right, which is not a good thing in Buddhism. And Shatiputra says, no. The parents simply wanted to make it possible for the children to escape the peril of the fire and preserve their lives. They didn't commit a falsehood. Because if they were able to preserve their lives, then they would have already obtained a plaything of sorts. How much more so when through an expedient means they are rescued from that burning house? And so here from a Mahayana perspective, to appear to violate a precept like telling a falsehood for the benefit of others, to help somebody, to save, to alleviate their suffering, is considered to uphold the precept, basically. Because there's no self-centeredness involved. It's not for, the parent is not doing this for themselves. They're doing this for the children. So it's a selfless act. This parent is apparent to all the world. Their fears, cares, and anxieties, ignorance and misunderstanding have long come to an end, leaving no residue. They are endowed with expedient means and the paramita of wisdom. They have great pity, great compassion. that is constant and unflagging. At all times, they seek what is good and will bring benefit to all. And so then the Buddha goes on to, you know, sort of make the metaphor clear. It says, living beings drowning in the midst of all of this delight and amuse themselves unaware, unknowing, without alarm or fear. They race about to east to west. They encounter, and though they encounter great pain, they are not distressed by it. The Buddha said, when we encounter something, we should see what it is, and then we should see what else it is. Right? In other words, not just get hung up on the initial pleasure or the initial pain that will fade, but the underlying basis of this, which will return again and again and again. Shariputra, when the Buddha sees this and thinks to himself, I am the father of living beings, and I should rescue them from their inner sufferings and give them the joy of measureless and boundless Buddha wisdom so they may find their enjoyment. Okay. Okay, so let's see what your thoughts are on this or questions. Mm-hmm. Jackie.
Just thinking, when the parent lures the children out, how does the parent know that it's the best for the children? Because the children felt fine. They weren't feeling pain. And it's like, how do you know what's best for people? Mm. And is there some form of self-clinging in that? Because, you know, they don't want the children to die. And then how do they know it's not the children's time?
Mm-hmm. Well, so in the in the simile, the parent is the Buddha. So they are relying on their Buddha wisdom to be able to see the danger. I mean, think of a parent and a child. So the child often believes they know what's best for them, right? The parent may disagree, right? And why is that? Well, the child has a particular view, right? They've lived, their world is a child's world. Their view is a child's view. They have a certain amount of experience, right? And a certain amount of a sort of inner development to be able to see all of that and understand it. They're in the same world the parent is in, but their experience is so much smaller that they just can't have that large of a vision. And so that is, in fact, one of the great responsibilities of the parent, right, is to have that larger vision and know to the best of their ability. And I am not a parent, so I won't speak. Try not to speak beyond what I know. But they will act to the best of their ability for the best interests of the child. If there is self-centeredness in that, and there may be, because they love their child and they cling to them, or because they sort of project their identity into the child, and there's that. So it may not be a pure love. But if they're sincere, they're trying, right? And as practitioners, we need to respond when we're called. And so we discern. We try and be clear in our response. We may be more or less clear. And so once we've acted, we may see that there was some self-clinging. We may see that I had another motive, right? And so I can learn from that, right? Because that's what I want my life to be about. And so in a way, it's okay, you know, so we don't have to strive to be perfect. And we do the best we can. I'm sorry, buddy.
Is this simile applicable, like, only, is it only on the literal scale, or does it apply to one mind and to larger groups as well?
To the larger what?
To larger groups as well. Because I guess I see it as also applying as in one mind, as well as literally as a Buddha and disciples.
I'm not sure I know what you mean. What do you mean, one, does it apply to one mind?
When dealing with thoughts and things that want to hold, even when you see that the house is on fire, do expedient means like that apply within the self?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we are very much need to be in the mind of learning what skillful means is for us as individuals, you know. And so recognizing, that's why it's so important to, you know, that in our awareness, mindfulness, that we're actually seeing and recognizing what is appearing, the thought patterns, the emotional patterns, the reaction patterns, all of those ways we have about ourselves, so that we're not just practicing mechanically, but we're because each time we respond, right? Each time something arises, we respond in some way. And if we continue to pay attention, we'll see, is that helping? Is that response helping? And very often we see it's not when we respond the way we have. And so we're learning how to respond in different ways, how to even see in different ways. And so we're developing skillful means to be more and more effective, really, in our practice and meet those various things that we encounter that are, you know, the flames, so that we don't get so burned. We don't get, you know, we don't get caught for so long. In other words, it's getting easier. And in that way, because mind is universal at the same time that it's particular, we're also learning a lot about people, human beings, human nature, human consciousness. We're learning about history. We're learning about how things work, about how we work, you know? And so, which is extremely important when we are with other people, you know, and trying to be helpful, like Jackie was asking, you know?
So on that scale, when dealing with like global crises, and group mentality develops around something, can a group or larger number of people develop their own sense of expedient means to try to help?
I mean, I think this is an example. I hope it's a good example. You know, there's much that has come down to us that we've been given, and that happens person to person, teacher to disciple. But we're putting it into play every day. And so part of how we evolve as a community within an ever-changing world is to see, you know, to be, keep examining, you know, what are the things that we are bringing forth that are really helpful, and we want to strengthen those and keep it. And what are the things that maybe used to be helpful, like running to the Dokusan line? I mean, there was something about that that had power, right? And there were other aspects of it that weren't altogether good. And so there was a point at which it seemed like it was important to like shift that. So, yeah. I mean, isn't that really what we need? Is for groups to be developing skillful means, you know, in a larger way.
Thank you.
Question from Jacob. The children leave the house in search of a plaything and receive one. They never seem to realize that they were in danger. Is this suggesting that our liberation can be motivated solely by the desire for reward or enjoyment without recognition of the pain of samsara?
Is that a question with a hope at the end? I mean, who am I to say what's possible for someone? But I wouldn't count on it. I wouldn't wait for that. you know, challenge, pain, the difficulties of our life can be extremely motivating, right? because we don't want that to continue. We want more, you know. And so and that's also where every analogy, every metaphor, every simile is going to be imperfect. Okay, so you get a point where it breaks down a little bit. And so we don't know what happened to these children, right? They got in their carts, maybe they were riding off to their next adventure, and they look back and thought, oh my God, look, whew. Because the house is this, right? We can't actually leave it, not in that way. And so we're seeing the signs all the time. And yet, it can take a long time for us to actually recognize that everything is not okay. You know, we just keep adapting and adapting and adapting and explaining and explaining and explaining and outsourcing, off-putting, sending it out, blaming, right? So there are all kinds of ways that we can avoid or delay actually recognizing, I think I'm in trouble, right? I think my life is not what I want it to be.
There's one more. The other extreme. Is there a danger in resting in the faith that, quote, I too will become a Buddha?
What's the last part?
I too will become Buddha. Is there a danger in resting in the faith that I too will become Buddha?
Resting, yes. I mean, if resting means what? Like that's a warm blanket that you just pull over you and go to sleep? Yes. That is not helpful. But what is the real message there? Right? The real message is, because we do not have predictions made for us. But what's the real message there is that we have all of the qualities of a Buddha, and here we are, right, in the house of Buddha, that we have, you know, despite great odds, right, when you think about the various shifts and turns that just happen to arise in our lives that we encounter the Dharma, could have gone another way. And that we can engage this, right? And having Buddha nature means there's no debate about your capacity. So that's a good start, wouldn't you say? Okay.
I just want to pick up on that question. I don't know, you know, what the person intended by it, but I also hear another quality to that that actually feels really relevant to our practice. You know, when we're told to just sweep the floor with your whole body and mind, mm-hmm. That's another form of resting within a practice, not seeking, not trying to be like the best sweeper, da, 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 da.
That's right.
And so...
So what Shoan is speaking about is that word, resting. So there can be resting in which we go to sleep, we become complacent, we wait. The Buddha said, I'm going to become enlightened, so that's good. I can wait, you know. That seems a lot easier. But that's not, the Buddha wasn't speaking to that person, right? He was speaking to practitioners. And so what Shoan is speaking about is a more authentic form of rest, right? Because that's being passive. That's not really resting. A real form of rest is being at ease within this, right? So there's no conflict. There's no striving. There's no reaching for something that's outside. There's the faith, this sense, and maybe the experience that this moment is actually complete. And that when we look at it from the outside, it looks very ordinary. And compared to, you know, all kinds of fancy pants stuff, right? sweeping a floor. But that's from the outside. That's not it. And so practice is helping us to learn how to rest, because we work so hard. Right? We work so hard. And we bring that work, that hard way of working into practice. Right? And that's okay for a while, because that's what we've got, pretty much. You know? That's what we've learned in our own particular ways. But eventually that shifts. Okay. Any last... Yes.
Well, there's one more. Okay. And there were a couple of people who brought this up toward the end of the third chapter. There's a long bit about the horrible, hellish things that will happen to people who defame the Lotus Sutra.
Yeah, I told you.
Why so much time spent on this? Is it just having to do with the historical things mm-hmm. going on in Buddhism at the time, sectarianism? Mm-hmm.
You know, it's interesting. Donald Lopez in this book said that why does the sutra, you know, it talks a lot about reading it, about reciting it, about writing it down, about, you know, he says almost obsessively. And that there's a lot about if a person fails to have faith but instead slanders this sutra, immediately they will destroy all the seeds for becoming a Buddha in this world. Right? So there's a lot about the danger of turning against the sutra. Right? Or trying to share the sutra with somebody who doesn't have faith, isn't asking, basically. And so if you think about that, what is the expedient means of that? Or what is the danger of ignoring that? I mean, what is happening when you slander, when you turn against, when you want to destroy something that has the capacity to help you, to free you, to liberate you? Where are you putting yourself in relationship to it? Right.
You put yourself in the center.
You're putting yourself in the center, and also you're putting yourself against, outside of. You know, so this emphasis on faith. I mean, just think about it. If you have faith in your zazen, or rather in the moments when you are not so sure, right? You're there, but you're questioning, you're doubting. You may be doubting your capacity, or you may be doubting, does this work? Is this for real? Or you may be thinking, is this something I should actually be studying? What does that do internally in terms of your relationship with your zazen, right? This teaching, it creates quite a distance, right? It makes it extremely difficult to give yourself to it, because that faith is, that trust isn't there, right? Our heart isn't, it's like we don't want to make ourselves vulnerable to that without the faith and trust. And so what I hear in this, you know, and it's very stark, it's kind of very fire and brimstone, is a kind of a warning to about the importance of faith, and to not destroy it, you know, not injure another person's faith, and also to not try and offer something to somebody that they're not asking for. Because if you do, they might actually turn against it when at another, because right now it's not expedient means. And so they might react against it where at a later moment, they might actually be open to it, and then they could hear it, and you might have injured that possibility. So, and I think that's a quality and aspect of Buddhism that is very good, right? In a world where we see what happens when religion is forced, trying to be forced upon people. I mean, it's a nightmare, right? And so there's at once this universal vow to liberate the suffering of all beings, and at the same time, all these cautions about don't teach this to a person who shows up in this way. Don't teach it to a person who shows up in this way. You know, which seems kind of like not very generous. But if you look at what's being described, it's just different places that people can be in where they're not going to, you know, they're not receptive. You know, they're not going to be able to use it well. So that's the way I hear it. Okay. And part of what Lopez says, I got lost in my own train of thought, is that all of those sort of comments about being slandered that scholars speculate is because that was happening. Because remember, this is early in the Mahayana tradition. These sutras are coming out, and it's like, wait a minute. Like, how could the Buddha have taught this? Right? This isn't one of the original teachings, because those have been acknowledged and verified and locked away. We know what the Buddha taught. This isn't part of that canon. And so he speculates that that part of that is sort of speaking to the time and some of the pressures that practitioners might have been experiencing, you know, that might have been directed towards some of these new Mahayana teachings that were being challenged. Kind of interesting to think about it within context, you know. But of course, we should, because it's always in context. Okay, so Yusen, did I present at the beginning of the ongo the sort of the chapters we'll be studying for each? Oh, rats. Okay, I meant to do that before I came, and I forgot. So I can't remember. We'll send it out. Okay, and we'll do that soon, because we're going to meet again in 2 weeks, okay, 2 weeks from tonight for our next meeting, and so that you can have some time. Yeah, I think that's enough for now, for tonight. Seku, would you like to bring us to a close here? The four vows? So Seku is going to chant the four vows, and if you will mute you so you can chant from home. Okay, thanks for coming tonight. Be well. Hope to see you soon.